Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you again for listening. Hope it continues to enjoy what we're doing. We certainly love having you listening.
We do, very much so. We're very lucky to have listeners.
We are. And what have I been doing this week? I've been reading the new Stephen King novel called The Institution, which is a very clever piece of work indeed, about a cross between Tom Brown's School Days and Lord of the Flies. It's set in the in an institution in the middle of the woods in Maine, where they
kids' institution.
Yes, yes, where they kidnap or abduct very, very clever children, and it is it's a fascinating story and very chilling, but. King at his best, really is.
It's a cool premise.
It is, yes. And can they ever escape, is the question.
But they're so clever, so surely they'd be able to.
Well, that's the
crux of it.
There's the dilemma. But I much enjoyed it. What about your week?
Yes.
You went to Top Boy.
I went to the premiere of Top Boy, starring my client, Kane Robinson, also known as Kano, who's a very successful musician who also just launched an album which is going down incredibly well. So that's great.
I can honestly say I've never heard his music.
No, I know. Don't think it's necessarily quite your... but everyone... I mean, it's probably one of the most incongruous pairings in life, me and Kano. But yeah.
Well, that's great.
But it works well. And also my client Des Hamilton did the casting. So it was a big deal. Drake was there. Do you know who Drake is?
No, sorry.
Drake is a hugely successful Canadian musician who is responsible for the rebirth of Top Boy. Top Boy was originally made in 2011. Uh-huh. And there were two series, and then Channel 4 commissioned a third series, and then the new then head of Channel 4, Piers Wenger, if anyone's interested, decided to cancel it and make Indian Summers instead and turn Channel 4 into BBC. Or ITV, even. And then it got put on Netflix and Drake watched it and he was like, we need more Top Boy. So his production company went to Netflix and were like, you need to make this. And so he made it happen. Pretty
wonderful.
Amazing.
Wonderful.
So yeah, he was like basically responsible for the whole thing. And it would, I mean, the people of East London were going crazy for Drake being in the Hackney Picture House.
Splendid. How
so
wonderful.
Were my colleagues who I took with me who were all dumbfounded and were shaky legs. And I've never listened to any of Drake's music, so it doesn't mean anything to me. Well, but I thought it was very funny how starstruck they were.
Well, I think that's wonderful. People still can be starstruck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they lost their minds.
It's terrific. Yeah. It restores some of my faith in humanity, which has got a bit blurred this week, given the shenanigans in the House of Commons. But I'm delighted if people can be genuinely thrilled to meet someone.
Yeah, it was good. It was good
I think
fun.
It makes a great deal of difference.
Good fun.
Well, this week we are dealing with one, probably, of the most famous murders of modern times.
In the UK.
In the UK.
Yeah, I agree.
It was a murder that captured the imagination of the nation. Mm. And all because of one simple photograph of two young girls wearing Manchester United tops.
Football shirts.
With Beckham on the back.
Yeah, I remember.
And that picture is embedded in my mind, and I'm sure in many, many other people's minds. It is an unforgettable image.
A bit like the Sarah Payne photo.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a profound, iconic image that it serves only to underline the horror of the crime.
So this week we're doing Ian Huntley. Oh, we're going to call it the Soho Murders, or...
I don't mind. The Soho Murders is fine with me.
Okay, well, there we go. The Soho Murders.
Ian Kevin Huntley was born on the 31st of January 1974 in Grimsby in Lincolnshire. He was the first son of Kevin and Linda Huntley. He was devious, manipulative, and it eventually turned out a paedophile. But Huntley's face will forever be known because it was somehow round and flat. And he always looked, whenever he appeared on television or whenever he saw a photograph of him, rather like a zombie. He was blank. There was no little or no animation in his face. But he had a distinctly checkered past. As everybody will probably remember, the two girls went missing shortly after a quarter past six in the evening, a sunny August evening in 2002. It was August the 4th. They'd been at a barbecue, Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. Holly Wells' parents had been having a barbecue and Jessica had been invited, and the two girls set off to buy sweets from the local shop. Nothing all that difficult or unusual about that. But as they returned to Holly's, on their way back to Holly's house, they passed the Tide Cottage inhabited by Ian Huntley, who was the caretaker at the Soham Village College, the secondary school. His partner, 4 years older than he was, Maxine Carr, was actually a teaching assistant at Holly and Jessica's school. Huntley later insisted that he was brushing his dog, Sadie, when he saw the two girls out of the front window and opened the door and went out to see them. Oh, nothing all that exceptional in that, you would say. In fact, they knew Maxine, both Jessica and Holly knew Maxine. And it's almost certain, although no one knows for sure except Huntley himself, that Huntley said, "Oh, Maxine's inside, you know, do come and see her." The two girls were ushered into this comparatively small house and they didn't emerge alive. What exactly happened and precisely why it happened remain quite a large mystery. At various points, Huntley gave various explanations for what went on in his cottage that Sunday evening. But at the outset, he didn't admit he'd even seen them, and indeed joined in the search, which began shortly before 10 that same Sunday evening, when the parents of both Holly and Jessica contacted the police. Over the next 12 days, there was a manhunt of considerable proportions conducted by Cambridgeshire Constabulary. Many of the villagers in Soham, in Cambridgeshire, turned out to help look for them, including Ian Huntley. It should be said that Maxine Carr wasn't in Soham on that Sunday evening. She was visiting her mother, who was lived in Grimsby. Indeed, that's where Maxine and Ian Huntley met, in a nightclub in Grimsby. Nevertheless, Maxine returned and Huntley joined in the search. Huntley was also interviewed memorably by a number of reporters, BBC's Look East and Sky News, in which he was memorably suggested to him that he could have been the last person to see the girls alive. "Oh yes," he said, "I suppose I could."
What, had he admitted that he'd seen them through the window?
No.
No, he was just...
No.
They were like, it just could be the case.
Yeah, it could be. Throughout these 12 days, no sign of the bodies, no sign of the girls. David Beckham even made a televised appeal as they were wearing his shirt. That didn't work either. Eventually, Huntley's appearance on television was to tell against him because his track record, particularly of attacking young girls and women, would come to the attention of the police because they were contacted by more than one woman who'd come across Huntley.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Huntley, I'll come to that, and Huntley was eventually in the late evening of the 16th of August, was taken in for questioning. In particular, about his record for rape or underage sex. Maxine Carr was also taken into questioning, in for questioning. It should be added here that Maxine Carr had given Huntley an alibi. She told the police that she was back in Soham in the cottage on the night the girls disappeared.
But she wasn't.
She certainly wasn't. She didn't get back until the Monday.
That's perverting the course of justice.
It is, and indeed she was convicted of perverting the course of justice, finally. It gradually began to emerge after the police took Huntley and Carr into custody for questioning. They searched the house and the school where he worked and found, among other things, the two Manchester United shirts. Why on earth Huntley took them back and hid them in the school dustbin is beyond me. If this is, you know, a premeditated murder, it would have thought the last thing he would want to do. But nevertheless, he did.
Maybe he wanted to look at them again.
Perhaps so. Perhaps trophies, as you say.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible. What actually happened on the morning of Monday, August the 5th, is still a matter of some speculation. What is clear is that that night, Huntley, by now, had killed both Holly and Jessica. We'll come to exactly how and why in a moment. But he'd put them in the boot, the bodies, in the boot of his red Ford Fiesta overnight. And the following morning, he'd driven them to the outskirts of RAF Lakenheath, about a dozen miles away, and dumped them in a ditch. There is some speculation that, in fact, he went back to the bodies, as we've talked about before, you know, returning to the scene of the crime, returning to the bodies, that he went back to the bodies and poured petrol on them and set fire to them. Some say that was a day or two later. Some say it was on the Monday morning. We are not sure. In my own mind, I'm sure that he probably did it on the Monday morning. And I'm sure in my own mind too, that it was to conceal evidence of some kind of forensic nature, DNA, whatever it may be. On the 20th of August, Huntley is formally charged with the murders. At that point, he has retreated into what was his default position, a kind of zombie-like silence. He wouldn't collaborate with the police. He wouldn't answer questions. He was looking into the middle distance. He went into full I'm mad mode. So much so that he was sent to Rampton Secure Mental Hospital in Nottinghamshire for assessment. The assessment was telling. In particular, the psychiatrist who examined him said that there was no chance whatever that Huntley was mad. He was calculating, callous, dreadful. He was a man who liked to hide behind being a little silly, a little daft. Dr. Christopher Clark, the chief consultant forensic psychiatrist, said in court, "Although Mr. Huntley made clear attempts to appear insane, I have no doubt that the man currently and at the time of the murder was both physically and mentally sound, and therefore, if he's found guilty, carried out the murder totally aware of his actions." There is no doubt in my mind, never has been the slightest doubt in my mind, that Huntley was more than aware of his actions. Indeed, in spite of the fact that he later was to maintain that there was no sexual motive to the crime, I believe there was. I believe that he was severely tempted by the sight of these two young women. And I believe he had a long track record of it. It was ironic that on the very day that Huntley was finally questioned by the police, that a gamekeeper discovered the skeletonized and decomposed bodies of Holly and Jessica in a ditch. August the 17th, 2002. What actually happened in that small house remains a mystery. At one point, Huntley is said to have made a 90-minute tape recording of an explanation which he was to give to his father because he intended to kill himself. He made an attempt on his life in 2006. And indeed, the tape came to light, printed partly in the Sun. Huntley tried to insist in his quotes explanation that it was all a terrible accident. One of the girls had a nosebleed and the other one needed to go to the toilet. So they'd taken them upstairs to the bathroom where one had, quotes, fallen into the bath, which just happened to be full of water.
That's ridiculous.
Mm. And goodness me, drowned.
Just like that.
Mm.
Cool.
The other.
Because an 11. Were they 11?
10.
10. 10 year old girl couldn't get herself out of a bar.
Yeah. It defies belief. Huntley as a whole defies belief. The other one went, I think the phrase Huntley later used was, went skiz on me. So I took her downstairs to the living room to try and calm her down. Well, he also took away her mobile phone because she was just about to dial 999. Mm. You know, he he strangled her, basically. He killed both girls quite deliberately. No one wants to add to the trauma of their parents. Imagine losing a 10-year-old daughter. It's unimaginable. And I don't want to speculate unnecessarily what Huntley might or might not have done to the girls. But I am only too well aware of Huntley's track record. There was not simply the discovery of the Manchester United shirts. There was forensic evidence, soil evidence, of the, good DNA
stuff
evidence.
Stuff in the back of the car, maybe.
Yeah. But he, by this time, of course, Huntley had resorted to his default position, and I think one policeman described it as blank-eyed, silent, zombie-like. But the thing about Huntley is that he had a long track record. Although Huntley would insist subsequently that there was no sexual interference with either girl, and also insist that he wasn't evil in any way, he had a track record. In August 1995, for example, he was 21, and there was a joint investigation launched by police and social services in his hometown of Grimsby after a 15-year-old girl admitted having sex with him. No prosecution took place. In March 1996, the following year, he was investigated again over allegations that he'd been having sex with an underage girl, but again, he wasn't charged. In April 1996, the following month, Huntley was investigated yet again over allegations of underage sex, and this allegation too, there was no charge.
Why was he not charged for any of these?
The following month, he was investigated over further allegations of having sex with a 13-year-old girl, and yet again, no prosecution followed. 2 years later, I'm sorry, this is a litany, but it proves my point. 2 years later, in April 1998, Huntley was arrested on suspicion of raping a woman. He admitted having sex with her, but claimed it was consensual. The police decided not to proceed. The following month, in May 1998, He was formally charged with rape and remanded in custody after an 18-year-old Grimsby woman claimed to have been raped by him on her way home from a nightclub. The charge was dropped after Crown Prosecution Service determined there was no realistic chance of a conviction. And then, in July 1998, he was investigated once more over allegations he had indecently assaulted an 11-year-old girl the previous September. Again, no charges. One final allegation came to light in July 1999, when a woman was raped and Huntley was interviewed by police about his possible involvement. But he was provided with an alibi by none other...
Maxine Carr.
This is the man who insists there is no sexual motive to the attack on Holly and Jessica. And yet, and this is the terrible truth, which in fact led to a major inquiry, none of those charges were known to the Cambridgeshire Constabulary, even though there'd been a criminal record check on Huntley so that he could get a job in a school.
Yeah, because he shouldn't be working in a school with the...
Both the Humberside Police and the Cambridgeshire Police were brutally criticised in what was known as the Bishop Report on their actions. There was a very flimsy attempt to explain it by saying, oh, well, as no charges were actually brought, there was data protection had to come into play.
Wasn't that the whole point of a CRB check or whatever it's called?
Suffice to say that a number of very senior police officers lost their jobs over the failure to identify Huntley as an obvious suspect, like 10 minutes after the girls went missing.
And he shouldn't have been working in a school anyway.
No. And, well, but on the other hand, Maxine Carr was plausible enough. And
she'd covered up for him before.
She had covered up for him before. Absolutely. And indeed, subsequently, was to admit that she had given him an alibi for the Sunday evening, which resulted in her being charged with perverting the course of justice. She was also charged with two counts of assisting an offender.
Fair.
They finally come to trial at the Old Bailey in 2005. In front of Mr. Justice Moses. Huntley claimed that it's an accidental drowning and he accidentally suffocated her to stop her screaming. He, of course, pleaded not guilty. No surprise there, then.
Well, he probably thought he'd get away with it, considering he'd got away with every other one.
Yeah, well, I think one former girlfriend, I was very interested in evidence from one former girlfriend, who explained that Huntley would often feign madness when he was being investigated by the police. It was one of his tactics. Carr pleaded guilty to perverting the course of justice, but not guilty to assisting an offender. She effectively stated that she wanted to protect her boyfriend, Huntley, but that she didn't know anything about what he'd actually done. She believed he was innocent. In the end, the jury accepted that argument, and she was indeed only convicted of perverting the course of justice. And indeed, remarkably quickly, Huntley spent 3 days in the witness box being lambasted by the prosecution counsel, Richard Latham, for being a liar, talking rubbish, this complete nonsense, you killed those two girls. Huntley, blank stare throughout, denied every word of it. Finally, the jury of 7 men and 5 women retired to consider Huntley's guilt. They retired for 5 days and couldn't reach a conclusion. They were then given an instruction by the judge that he would accept a majority verdict of 10-2, which is finally what they returned. It's clear that at least 2 members of that jury did not believe that Huntley killed Holly and Jessica.
And don't you think that was based on evidence because of their bodies being disposed of what you know.
You can never tell what happens in jury rooms.
No,
it is
true.
One of the great mysteries of life, of what juries believe and don't believe. But
I mean, you have to believe that you 100% can know it was true, and I guess that...
Beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. And I suppose, not that I don't think he's not guilty, but I suppose you can look at it and say, one saw him, no one...
Yeah,
there's no evidence.
Forensic evidence.
Some evidence, but not...
Yeah, and there's evidence that he had opportunity because he was clearly on his own in the village that afternoon in August 2002.
Mm.
But the jury were not told about his track record of allegations.
Why not? Because you can't use it, can you?
No,
you
it's can't prejudicial.
Use, you can't use it, yeah.
Absolutely prejudicial.
It's mad, that.
And it
Is
wasn't
it
until after his conviction that the true scale
of what he'd,
of
done,
what he'd done before
came
to light. Not least, and the papers went berserk the day after his conviction because they found his first wife, Claire Evans, who actually said in an interview, well, if only I'd let him strangle me, those girls would never have died. Then he could have gone, he would have been convicted of killing me. He clearly had a major track record of violence mm-hmm. towards women. His brother, Wayne, Claire, his first wife, incidentally, left Ian Huntley for his brother, Wayne, and finally left Wayne as well, and now with her third husband. Claire was pregnant by Huntley at one stage, and he told her he was going to do something to the baby. If you have that child, I'm going to do something to it. His brother Wayne then wrote a book called The Blood We Share in 2011, describing his cushy life in prison and how he liked watching Manchester United, and he had a Sky Plus Xbox.
Wayne, ill-advised.
Yes, well, Huntley wasn't given he was given a life sentence by Mr. Justice Moses, but no maximum minimum term was set because at that point there was a debate going on in British legal circles about whether or not a politician could intervene in the judicial process. You may remember in the past that Home Secretaries could effectively say, well, he stays in prison for life. What you might describe as the Ian Brady, Myra Hindley position.
Or release them. Who was the man that we did? He wrote to the Lord, the Home Secretary and got released. It's an old one, like a 50s one, I can't remember.
Well, finally, Huntley was given life with a minimum term of 40 years. Huntley, for me, is one of the most profoundly monstrous figures that we deal with because he inspired, he was only 28 when he killed those poor girls. He was devious. He was clearly had very big issues with young girls. I think one prison officer has described him memorably as in jail, as having a sarcastic nonchalance, as if it didn't really matter. It was also said, and I think this is incredibly telling, that he had a true psychopathic personality. He treated other people as if they were merely detritus. Why else would he set fire to the two girls? They are irrelevant to him. They are merely objects.
Yeah.
He's done what he wanted. Fine, we'll get rid of them. He's awfully, also clearly not the brightest of men because otherwise why would you take the Manchester United shirts back? Except, although I take your point, as a possible trophy.
Mm.
Huntley, of course, remains a very, very high profile prisoner. He's been attacked.
I was going to say you get really badly beaten up in prison for killing children.
I think
the first
time he was scalded. He then tried to commit suicide. Then he had his neck cut by another prisoner. But he seems oblivious to it, intent, if you like, on serving out his time. He would theoretically be available for release when he's 68. I have a feeling that that will never happen on the sheer grounds of notoriety. I think there'd be an outcry. I think Jessica Chapman's father said, the next time I see Huntley, I hope he's going to be in a coffin, because that was the last time I saw my daughter. This was a crime that truly did shock the nation. Maxine Carr didn't serve very long because she'd been on remand in prison for a long time before they eventually came to trial. So in May 2005, she was released after serving 21 of the 42 months of her sentence. She was one of the only four people to be given a fresh identity. Mary Bell, of course, was one we've dealt with. And the killers of...
Jamie Bulger.
Yeah, Jamie Bulger. Maxine Carr, however, inspired such tremendous rage that a number of people who looked like her were attacked.
That's awful.
The so-called lookalike victims. They were attacked, one of them severely.
That's awful.
Maxine Carr, of course, has got a new identity. And indeed, in 2011, she gave birth to her first child, who also has anonymity, guaranteed anonymity for life. She's done her best to resume what you might describe as a normal life, while Huntley resides in comfort at our expense. Now, again, we find ourselves confronting the same argument often, but what should happen to Huntley? Should he not have given, which I believe he should have been, should he not have been given a whole life term? The reason he wasn't is that the jury and the judge believed there was no sexual motive. Under the conditions of a whole life term, one of the criteria is that there should be a sexual motive. There were children, that's one criteria. There were two of them, that's another criteria. And I believe there was a sexual motive, which I believe should have said that he got a whole life term at the very beginning. At the moment, he hasn't and will not have.
I agreed to whole life term for him.
Yeah, I can't see why Huntley deserves to even the possibility of release. Not even the possibility. I mean, this is a man who committed the most foul, evil act, taking the life of two utterly innocent, charming, beautiful, clearly lovely little girls, and for no reason than his own pleasure. It is a truly sadistic, dreadful act.
Yeah, thanks, Dad. That was...
Yes, it's not really a thank you. Not really a thank you one, is it?
It's a tough one.
Huntley, there is something about him. He does feign madness. He does pretend to be stupid when he isn't.
Mm.
And there's something that makes your skin crawl about him.
Yeah, very chilling. Well, there we go, Ian Huntley, also a murders.
Yes, not, I'm afraid, a very jolly one.
Not at all.
Anyway, what jolly thing can we think of just to end on?
What jolly thing? Oh, well, we're going to the Downton premiere on Monday.
We are. I've got to go and collect my tickets from the What's It office or something.
I think you just get them is it in Leicester Square? I can't remember.
Yeah, it's in a hotel. You get the
click. You get it opposite, in that hotel opposite.
Yeah.
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 Mine have been delivered to me, obviously.
Of course,
I'm
yes.
So grand.
Oh, I know, of course. I'm going to have to queue up like an ordinary person. Yes, I'm going to be there. My nose pressed against the window.
So you'll be in the back in the gods.
I won't be in the best seats.
I'm joking.
It'll go on forever as well. That's the thing about premieres. You also sit there for ages when a lineup takes place.
A big lineup, a hefty cast in that.
Yeah,
movie.
There's a big lineup. Big.
Take a while for Maggie to get up on the stage.
Yeah, big lineup. I remember going to the premiere of the film that Kevin Costner was left in the cutting room floor. It's Jeff Goldblum. And they all got up on the stage. It took forever. It was at Lincoln Center in New York. And it took hours to get to the film.
They don't take that long these days, to be fair. They don't do too, unless you go to a royal one.
And if you have
Because if you go to a royal one, you have to wait for the royals to get there, and then you have to the royals have to leave before everyone can leave.
Oh, I did a royal one. Oh, dear. Yeah.
Yours was a royal one.
I got, yes, Charles and Diana.
Yeah.
Almost Jeffrey, the last public engagement they made together. Yes.
Jeffrey produced a film called When the Whales Came.
And the premiere was in 1989.
And Princess Diana and...
Prince Charles
were there. Sadly, I wasn't because I was too little.
Yes, and Dan had just gone to prep school.
Had he?
In the country.
I didn't know
about
that.
2 days before. I took him into the projection box in the Odeon Leicester Square.
This is so sweet.
So he could have a look at what's, you know,
what it would be like.
What it would be like. And then we drove him down to the country. Mm. Sweet.
Sweet. Right, well, there you go. Thanks, Dad, and thanks, everyone.
Should we just do the thank yous?
Thank you to everyone. Thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon. Thank you to Audio Boom for looking after us. To my friend Barney, who's helped us make the sound better, and my friend and colleague Hannah, who helps me with all things podcasty, and to my brother Dan, who wrote the music, and my friend George, who did our caricature, and to you, Jeffrey.
Thank you
for doing all the hard work.
Thank you very much, Molly. I have to say, sometimes I find ploughing through quite as much grief as I find myself doing can be a little challenging. I have to often take breaks, get away from it.
Yeah.
But however, I do hope, and as I say every time, please don't have nightmares and do be careful out there.